This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 8th of May 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to a special election edition of Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Steve Bloomfield. David Cameron's Conservative Party has won the UK general election, this time with a majority of their own.
I've just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, and I will now form a majority Conservative government. I've been proud to lead the first coalition government in 70 years, and I want to thank all those who worked so hard to make it a success.
Three other leaders have resigned, including Labour's Ed Miliband, after a catastrophic defeat for his party.
Britain needs a Labour Party that can rebuild after this defeat, so we can have a government that stands up for working people again. And now it's time for someone else to take forward the leadership of this party.
The Lib Dems' Nick Clegg has gone, so too Nigel Farage, the UKIP leader, after he failed to win his seat.
Now, I said, as this campaign went on, that if I didn't win, I would stand down as leader of UKIP. And I know that you in the media are used to party leaders making endless promises that they don't actually keep, but I'm a man of my word.
We'll come back to that. George Brock and Isabel Hilton join me to look back at the election and ahead at the new government. That's the election special Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the editor of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton, and from City University, George Brock. George and Isabel, welcome to you both. Firstly, let's get the important things out of the way. Did we all stay up? Or George, did you had some sleep.
I went to bed after midnight. I thought there's really not much going on here. I don't really believe these exit polls, but I'm going to wait. I got up at 6, which was exactly the right moment to get up. A lot of very good stuff was about to happen.
Isabel, you stayed up a bit later.
I stayed up till 2:30, and then it all seemed to be going one way, so I thought I might as well go to bed.
Okay, I stayed up till 4:30. I could see it was going one way, but I thought I'd just carry on drinking. let's look at the exit poll. George, you mentioned there, you know, you weren't sure about the exit poll, and that was the first big shock of the night, wasn't it? Because in the run-up to this election, to polling day, the polls have got tighter and tighter. It's been the Tories on 34, Labour on 33. Then it was Labour on 35 and the Tories on 34. It was going to be a hung parliament. Everyone was sure of this. And then there was an exit poll which said, no, hang on, Labour have been quite badly beaten.
Well, before we get into the pollsters and whatever mistake they made, let's not forget that both politicians and journalists absolutely love neck and neck. Politicians like neck and neck because it gets the vote out, and journalists love it because it cranks up the tension of the story. So we've all invested a bit in a description that actually turns out to be quite wrong.
But it was a description that the polls, you know, for example, we've seen in the US election in 2012, lots of media saying, oh, it's very close, when if you look at the polls, it really wasn't. The polls did say, this is a dead heat.
Yeah, but the polls aren't infallible. They were good in 2010, but they weren't perfect in the ones before that, and they went completely wrong in quite a similar way in 92. And in 92, the pollsters had to sit down. There was a bit of denial, you know, it wasn't really our problem, there was a late swing, da-da-da. Then, you know, more sensible people kind of got on top, and they had a really serious review, and a lot of the polling techniques being used now date back to the revisions after 92. Well, that process is now going to happen all over again.
Isabel Hilton, I want to sort of get off the polls in a moment, because you know there's not much that can be gained by everyone sort of gnashing their teeth and saying, well, the poll said this and actually the election was something else. As George says, go back to 1992, which was the last time this happened where there was a major surprise. The issue there, many of the pollsters said, apart from some issues with how they work out who's who, was this phenomenon of shy Tories, people being slightly embarrassed about
saying they're conservatives.
And some people are saying there was perhaps something similar this time around.
Well, I think it's the only explanation. I mean, the polls were not wrong across the board. I was in Scotland last weekend, and a poll came out suggesting that the SNP would win 55 seats. And we all said, good grief, surely that can't be true. And actually they won 56. So it they were right in some way. So something was going on in England with the responses. And my best guess, completely off the top of my head, is that, yes, it's a similar phenomenon, that people are... We have the shy Tory phenomenon again.
We'll come on to Scotland in a moment, because that also feeds into what happens next. But George Brock, let's look at the ruins of the Labour Party campaign. Is it fair to say that actually they lost this election 4.5 years ago when they elected Ed Miliband, who, you know, wasn't seen as being a very good leader, and B, allowed this narrative to exist, to grow, that the entire financial problem in this country was down to Labour rather than the Great Recession?
I wouldn't really put the heart of their failure quite onto either of those things, although I think both of those played a role. The Labour Party tends not to win and tends to lose when it doesn't go out beyond its core vote and its heartlands. And I think what we were watching last night was a Labour Party which was doing fine in its core areas and its core vote, but it wasn't extending out past that. Now, that's partly to do with Miliband and his strategic choices about policies that he made. It's partly about the mindset of the party after years of Tony Blair and New Labour and so on. I tend to think that these things are strategic choices made some way out.
Isabel, there will be a great debate within the Labour Party, outside the Labour Party, about what went wrong. And already we're hearing some people saying, the problem was that Ed Miliband was too left-wing, that he needed to move to the centre. I'm struggling to see what the precise policies are, though, that were necessarily seen as too radical, too left-wing.
Well, I rather agree. I mean, it does remind me of Kinnock's defeat when he ran against Major, where again there was a very strong expectation of Labour, and it came to pieces on the night. But
at least with that, there was, you know, the famous poster of, you know, Labour's tax bombshell, which the Tories were able to say, look, for middle class people, their taxes will rise because the 40% rate, yeah, that, you know, that now people who are earning just over £40,000 pay, you know, that rate would go up. There is no equivalent issue now that I can see.
What I do think, I disagree with George slightly, that I do think the narrative of economic incompetence was pretty strong. And I think the Tories have made a great deal of, you know, in many ways a very questionable economic policy. They have managed to blame the Labour Party for the impacts of the global recession. They have actually managed to blame the Labour Party, which was pretty much following Thatcherite policy. So it's been quite slick and insistent narrative that you can't trust Labour with the economy. And given to the degree that I suppose Ed Miliband was trying to distance himself from New Labour, it opens up an opportunity to enforce that narrative.
Steve, I think you're right that there wasn't quite a single tax bombshell moment, but I do think the Conservatives managed to entrench and embed the idea, going right back to the response to the crash, obviously, that Labour somehow weren't quite to be trusted on this issue. And that came out, I'm sure you remember the exchange in the individual leaders' interviews, where the lady kept saying to Ed Miliband, you know, if you're still in denial about your responsibility for the crash, how can I trust anything else you tell me, roughly speaking? And I think those kind of bits, they weren't quite as neat as a tax bombshell, but I think that idea did Labour a lot of harm.
But that's different from saying the party was too left-wing. It was that saying this party was seen as not being trusted on the economy.
I don't think it was anything quite as hard or clear-cut as too left-wing. There were some interventionist economic ideas. They didn't play a great deal of part in the campaign in the end. But I think it was more, it was a cross between that and the general issue of competence and capability. Don't forget that Labour won elections under Blair because, in a way, Blair's offer to the voters wasn't an ideological one. It was, I'm extremely capable, I can deal with anything that life throws at me, and I'm kind of easygoing, and I'm a big tent, and I'm trying to include lots of people.
And also he had the advantage that Tories had been in power for 18 years.
Tories had been
the public services weren't in a great state.
And there was a huge boom going on. No, he had a lot of other things going for him.
And he also got rid of Clause 4, and he distanced himself from the old traditional Labour, and he had the idea, you know, the image of a modernising figure.
To damage your opponent in some elections, you only need to plant some doubt. You don't need to kind of put out another thought about them and get everybody to believe it and recite it. You just have to plant some doubt.
Isabel, where do Labour go from here? Because, you know, you look at the electoral map, you think, well, OK, they've lost, you know, all but one of their seats in Scotland. So to win back in Scotland, they'll be in opposition to the SNP. They can't seem to win any seat outside of London in the south. So to do that, they're going to have to win seats off the Tories. And in the north of England, now in many of their seats, their biggest opponent is going to be UKIP. So looking at that, there is no sort of one straight direction you can point yourself in.
No, I mean, I think that we come back to this fundamental point of this election is that the map has been redrawn, and that if I were Labour, I mean, if you add all of the SNP seats onto Labour, you still don't get to a majority. So I think that I also happen to think that Labour, it'll take decades to recover in Scotland, honestly. I think that horse
by which
has bolted.
Time Scotland will be independent.
It may well be. But if I were Labour, I would worry about England, actually. And I think that what has started in Scotland as a reconfiguration of UK politics is now knocking into England. And if I were, heaven forbid, the new leader of the Labour Party, that's what I would look at.
George Brock, to move slightly away from Labour now, do you believe that any of the parties in the UK now are truly national parties, as in for the whole nation, not just for Scotland, Wales or England?
There hardly is one that qualifies for that description, which is why I think the really big dominating issue of the next Parliament is really going to be not just Scotland, although an awful lot of it will have a Scottish flavour for obvious reasons. But I think actually the question is, how are we defining a United Kingdom? What do we actually mean by uniting it? Now, this issue kind of arose before the Scottish referendum, and then it faded when the Scottish referendum actually said no in the end by just about a decisive margin. And then, unexpectedly, at least to everybody in England, the issue kind of came back from a slightly different direction. Now it's going to dominate things for a long time because if you... I can't imagine Scottish nationalists will go for another referendum immediately. You'd really want a very, very big lead for yes in the polls before you started that. But obviously it's in their mind. There's now going to be a presumably extremely bruising negotiation about money. Negotiations about money never last weeks. They last months and years. All of which is underpinned by this question is, what exactly is this state for? What does it do together? And is that worth having?
And on that question, Isabel, you know, there's been, during this election, there's been no talk really about constitutional reform. There's been no talk about voting reform. There's been no talk about the House of Lords. Do those issues suddenly come on the table? And are politicians able to look at what's happened around the country and go, you know what, actually we need to change our political system to better reflect the voting reality?
Well, I certainly hope so, because I think that is the only hope of keeping the United Kingdom together, if that is what people want to do. And I think that the response so far to the Scottish phenomenon has simply driven a bigger and a bigger wedge. I mean, including in the election campaign, pretty disgraceful things being said, which simply stimulated a stronger Scottish response. One of the more interesting things that's been said since the result became clear was oddly from Boris Johnson, not a man you would think of as advocating constitutional reform. But if I were looking at the long-term future of the United Kingdom, I would think that what the Scottish phenomenon is driving a process of constitutional reform, which, if intelligently conducted at this point, could actually save the Union. It would be a very different shape of country. It would be a much more federal structure. All these unanswered questions which were hastily thrown into the mix around the Scottish referendum, like English votes for English laws, like the discontent of the major English regions, like the problem of how do you have a federal structure when England has, you know, such a huge proportion of the population? You know, what do you do about that? It's time, really, and there is time now, I think, for a constitutional convention. We can't go on putting sticking plaster on these issues because it's just not going to work.
And yet, George, aside from the issue of Scotland, it's hard to find much appetite amongst voters for any of these issues.
Well, you mentioned House of Lords reform. That's absolutely the last place that I would start. I mean, governments have completely exhausted themselves getting stuck doing that. But look, here's another angle to come at it from, and this is why I think actually the appetite will be there. UKIP has just won, in round numbers, 3.8 million votes, for which they've got one MP, one single MP. They have strong views about constitutional change and England and English laws for English people and so on and so forth. And they're not the only people with strong views about this kind of issue. I just don't think it's going to disappear or come off the table. You are right in implying that House of Lords reform did not turn out to be the great popular cause that once thought it might be.
But not even that. I mean, you know, we had, you know, it's ironic that we've had two referendums in this past parliament and actually neither of those issues are really settled. You know, aside from Scotland, there was the referendum on a form of proportional representation, the alternative vote, back in 2011. It had a tiny turnout and was beaten by 2/3 to 1/3.
Yes, but people's attitudes to and appetite for change will be governed and I think influenced by events. Firstly, there are these electoral figures, which I think will stoke the fire reasonably well. There is also the question, obviously, not only of Scotland, but there is also an EU referendum now almost inevitable for 2017. There are some ways in which these two issues can get entangled, and both of them raise constitutional questions in their different ways. So do I think this is going to go off the table? No, I don't.
I think the great mistake would be to assume that if you change nothing, nothing changes. And I think we're in a moment when it's absolutely clear that very big changes are afoot. You can either go to meet them and manage them, or you can sit there with your fingers in your ears and have the country fall to bits.
But then the question is, who is the leader that is going to meet them and manage them? So, for example, you know, Nick Clegg of the Liberal Democrats, that this is something they believe very strongly in, and yet they got 8% of the vote. They've got 8 seats. The Lib Dem, you know, Nick Clegg has gone.
But don't forget that the Scots have a huge mandate to demand what used to be called Devo Max, you know, further powers for the Scottish Parliament. And there was and David Cameron's response to that the day after the referendum was that we need to do something about English votes for English laws. So we are committed to a sort of reform. I would just like to see it being a good one.
George, on that issue of David Cameron's comments during a campaign and after them, as Isabel mentioned, during the referendum campaign, it was a very much a one nation message, we're better together. And then the moment the polls closed, the morning after, once the victory had been secured, suddenly, some would argue, quite divisive. The reverse seems to have happened in this election, in that, you know, he put up posters where there was a picture of Alex Salmond literally picking the wallet out of an English voter. You know, there was all this rhetoric about these scary Scots who are going to come and take our money. And yet today he's saying, I'm a one nation Tory. I'm going to govern for the whole nation. Let's leave aside which one he really is. If he is the latter, can he actually do that?
I think he has some decent qualifications for it, but I mean, no political leader, when you ask that kind of question, ever kind of looks perfect. But he will now, at least for a time, have quite strong authority in his own party. Don't forget that until quite a late stage in the campaign, quite a lot of Conservative MPs were wandering around saying, this guy isn't up to it. He has now proved the pollsters wrong. He's won a fairly satisfactory overall majority. Could be a little bit bigger to be ideal, but it's not bad. And he has decapitated three other party leaders. He has, therefore, a certain amount of initiative and a certain amount of honeymoon. They never last very long in Westminster, but at least he has some of that.
With a majority of 10 or 12.
Yeah, particularly not in the Tory party.
Particularly not in the Tory party, but all parties are pretty vicious to people who fail, and the reverse does to some extent apply to those who succeed. So he has a bit going for him. I think that... if I may imagine their conversations around the table, if you see what I mean, so, somebody is going to have to say to Cameron, you simply cannot go on making this stuff up on the back of a fag packet. It won't do. You know, this parliament is going to be dominated by this stuff, and we're going to have to get really serious about it. I just think, you know, he has a tendency to be superficial and careless about things. That seems fairly well attested. But on the other hand, he's also not as dumb as some people think he is. So I hope that he can take that lesson in. That's the optimistic version.
Okay. When I think of Tory governments, Isabel, with small majorities, I think of John Major from 92 to 97, who started off with a majority of 21, and it was slowly whittled away as, you know, he lost by-elections and then had to rely on Ulster Unionists, and then there were, you know, there were arguments over Europe and you know, the party split. Now, it's not necessarily the same situation now. The Tory party hasn't been in power for, you know, leading up to 18 years. But there's going to be this big issue of Europe. There is a large rump within the Tory party that won't be willing to have compromises. George said he might get a bit of a honeymoon. How much of a honeymoon do you think he might get?
I think he'll get a honeymoon until the referendum. Because his real problem is the absolutely die-hard anti-European wing of his party. And those people never give up. You know, you think it's like the last scene of the horror movie. You think you've killed them off and then up they come again. And those are the people that Major called bastards. And I'm afraid Cameron is going to have to deal with them, but they want a referendum. So he's got that until 2017. What I can't see, though, is the timetable of the kind of constitutional reform that he has, as George says, rather carelessly promised, which is going to be a long and difficult argument. There is going to have to be some kind of process there. It will have to come to a vote, if not a referendum. That will happen, I'm guessing, after the European referendum, by the time we actually get to any decision on that. And then he will have lost control of his anti-European wing. They will or will not have got what they want.
George Rock, constitutional reform, a referendum on the European Union. You know, there are lots of people who can happily talk about these issues for a very long time because they think they're incredibly important. But for most voters, they haven't voted for the Tories because of those issues. They voted for them because of economic issues or because they think that they like their school reforms, they like their welfare reforms, or so on. On those issues, where do the Tories go from here? Because they have been, you know, on the NHS, they've promised an extra £8 billion without necessarily saying how they're going to pay for it. On welfare, they've said they're going to cut £12 billion. Again, not really saying where that's going to fall. Do you feel those were just election pledges, which, you know, they weren't carved in stone, so, you know... Yeah, they don't necessarily have to be kept, and we can go back to it.
There's no tombstone in the Downing Street garden.
Or do you think he might try and find a different path forward?
No, I think they will make cuts, and they will be very unpopular. What we haven't had for quite a long time is that going alongside this constitutional question, which, whether or not people are bored by it, is still going to be a big political preoccupation. And you can also just assume on statistical probability, as it were, that there's going to be at least one major international crisis. We are not out of the wood with Greece and its repayments yet. The worst moment is June and July there. So we could spend the entire summer watching a really big financial crisis in Europe, which has huge implications and directly affects us. That could be the first thing with which this government deals. And it wouldn't be a bad idea, just I say in passing, if Cameron used some of his new kind of influence and pulpit, as it were, to reacquaint British public with the idea that there is a world beyond the Channel. He was interviewed for 28 minutes on that individual leaders thing, and other than migration, he wasn't asked a single question about foreign affairs, not one single one.
Well, I was going to say, you know, you talk about the world beyond the channel. That was the only issue about the world beyond the channel, which was the people who are crossing the channel to come here and take our jobs and our women. I paraphrase.
carry on.
We've mentioned migration. Let's then just keep on that for just a moment. It has not been the most edifying of spectacles over the last few years, hearing the rhetoric on migration. Isabel, do you think that's going to change at all now?
I don't think it's going to get much better. Honestly, I think that what the UKIP vote demonstrates is that, you know, this is an issue that people care about. They may be completely bored by the idea of constitutional reform, but they are not bored by the idea, as you say, that people are unfairly piling into Britain. And they're rather resistant to any, you know, evidence-based discussion of whether we take more than our share or whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. This is just a visceral emotional issue. And people who feel that they have lost out, that they've been hard done by, and it's an easy group to blame. And I think it won't die down. And I think that the Tories will not really encourage it to die down. I think they'll still try to outflank UKIP on this.
Following on from that, here's a prediction. Cameron has said that what he wants is reform out of the EU before he fights the referendum. I think he will get some kind of concession from his EU partners about migration and freedom of movement. Okay, freedom of movement is a sacred principle in the EU, I know, but nevertheless, the kind of instincts that are making migration very unpopular here are operating in a lot of other EU countries. I think his partners may cut him a little bit of slack. There will then be an EU referendum, and I think we will win it to stay in.
I think you're probably right on that. Although I'm wondering whether, is David Cameron the person that leads that campaign?
I think he'll have to be, won't he? Well, I mean,
He's going to have to be. Mm. He's going to have to be.
And he's going to have to manage his own party in the course of doing that, which is going to be hard.
And since I said at the start, we should mention something about Nigel Farage, who has stepped down as he promised, but only seems to be so he can go on holiday and come back in September and take up the reins again.
Not much of a departure, though.
Not really at all. But George, I mean, he's quite right to stay on, isn't he? I mean, he didn't win his own seat, but this has been a huge success for him. He's won almost 4 million votes.
Yes, I mean, they have made a mark. There's absolutely no question about that. And as I said, I think they will stay in the argument, and they are quite likely to be big participants in the argument about constitutional change. Because they are an English party. No, I do not think that UKIP is going to fade away. I mean, I think in 30 or 40 years' time, most of its voters will be dead, because they are relatively old. But no, for the time being, they're going to be a force, even if they've only got one MP.
But perhaps having won this clearly unexpectedly decisive victory, Cameron will not have to move any further to the right. I think that would be directly at odds with his One Nation speech. It will be interesting to see who he picks in his cabinet.
There are benefits to experience, and by now he ought to understand that you cannot go on giving concessions to that group on the right for whom Europe is an obsession, because you can never, ever give them enough. Yeah. It's never possible. And he ought to know that by now.
We've got about 20 seconds left. A word about the Liberal Democrats, Nick Clegg. I thought his speech was somewhat, we were right and the voters were wrong.
Well, if you're a Lib Dem, what else are you going to say? But I think they're down for now, but I think they will win back some of those seats next time.
George, their problem was they campaigned to the left of Labour in 2010 and then they joined a government of the right.
Yep, and if there was any job I wouldn't want, it's rebuilding that particular party. The Labour Party leader's next job is easy by comparison.
There we are. George Brock and Isabel Hilton, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on the Midori House post-election special. That brings us to the end of the programme. Midori House was produced by Ben Rylan and Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Caroline Harmagren. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Josh Fennett is here next. And then Marcus is back at 1900 hours with the menu. Midori House back again the same time on Monday, 1800 hours in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.